We're going to begin today. Thank you. We're going to be dealing today with Rabbi Yosef Messas. But before we do that, and you'll hear things you haven't heard. Believe me, very unusual stuff. But before that, I wanted to call attention to a few more things about Ben Amozig before we close him out. Also, answer two questions I received. One of them, okay, I will speak a little more softly. Actually, that's a good suggestion, Jonathan. Sometimes I get excited, though. Let me know if I'm too light. First, Shlomo Fish, who I don't know, yes, he is here with us. I mentioned last class, right at the beginning, someone asked if there's a parallel to what Ben Amozig says to the Rambam about some of our practices, you find them among the pagans. And I did mention that. I mentioned levirate marriage. But I need to stress the difference and why Ben Amozig was very opposed to the Rambam's view of sacrifice. It isn't that we're adopting a pagan practice because we're comfortable with it and the Torah can't get us away from it, so it compromises. That's the Rambam's approach in some of these areas. For Ben Amozig, these pagan practices were originally part of the ancient Jewish wisdom, which the ancients practiced. So it's a very big difference. Second, Yisrael, who is not here with us yet, so I assume he'll be here, asked me, how do I know that Pallier was the first Noahide in history? It's a good question. For those coming on, I see you coming on now, let me just apologize for my voice. Hope it's not too painful to listen to. So let me answer Yisrael's question. First of all, obviously, I don't know that there was never a Noahide, another Noahide in history. But what does it mean to be a Noahide? It isn't just someone who follows the Noahide laws. There could be plenty of people who do that. It means someone who is conscious of what the Noahide laws are. There was a revelation at Sinai. And that the Jews have the answer to what the Noahide laws are, so therefore you consult with rabbis. If you look at any of these Noahide sites, they always say you need to consult with rabbis about what you can and can't do. Until Pallier in the 19th century, early 20th century, I have never heard, I've never seen it in any Jewish literature, and I think it probably would be unimaginable that non-Jews would be consulting with rabbis about how to live their lives as Noahites. Anyone who was attracted to Judaism, who thought Judaism was correct, converted, as Pallier wanted to, and saw why he didn't. Basically, Ben Amozig convinced him not to. So, I can't say that Pallier was the first in history. What I can say is that he is the first Noahite in recorded history. That is, we have no prior example of a non-Jew living consciously as a Noahide until Pallier, at least as far as I know. In all the tshuva, the responsa literature, there's never a mention, as far as I know, of such a case. Okay, just quickly, a few things before we move on to Rabbi Yosef Messas. Smaller here, actually. I can bring up him for a minute. Just a few... Just a few insights from Ben Amozig's Israel and Humanity. Highly recommended. I'll go through them quickly. No more than 10 minutes. He calls attention to something really interesting. That if you look in Genesis chapter 20, you find Avimelech referring to Hashem in the singular. And you find Avraham referring to Elohim in the plural. And he says, what's going on there? Abraham is referring to God in the plural? And he develops the idea here that Jewish monotheism is moving in the direction here of paganism, to trying to show them that we can welcome you, but yet paganism has to view the different gods as attributes, not as independent gods. So that is quite interesting. I don't know who is controlling the screen here. I'm not controlling it. Maybe all of you have the ability to control, so I'll just ask not to do anything with it. Tech support can probably fix that. On page 114, he speaks about the fact how names like Elohim and other names in the Bible, including names of biblical figures like Pinchas, they're pagan names originally. Why? What's going on here? Why are the Jews, I mean Moses and others, why are they using pagan names? Again, I ask people not to touch anything on the screen. And he develops the idea that the Torah takes aspects of paganism and purifies it, makes it holy. We can develop this idea in great detail. There's other things. He speaks about how, according to Kabbalah, even paganism has sparks of holiness that you want to redeem, as it were. Rav Kook speaks about similar things. What else do I want to tell you? Okay, one more thing from this book. I've read this parsha numerous times. I never really noticed it until he points it out. If you look at the beginning of Genesis, you have the 7 days of creation. 6 days of creation and God resting. With the exception, if I'm not mistaken, of the second day, on all of the days, it mentions God saw that it was good. And then on the last day, after the creation of man, it mentions that it was very good, Tov Ma'od. And many commentators point out, it's pretty obvious, at least according to them, that only with the creation of man, which is the pinnacle of creation, does God look down and say, it's not just good, it's very good. And Amozig actually takes the exact opposite approach. If you look carefully at the Pesukim there, doesn't say it's very good after the creation of man. After man is created, it then says, God says about all of creation it was very good, that it was cumulative. But it specifically does not say about the creation of man that it was good. So why not? Ben Amozik says, because everything else is created, inherently it's good. The planets, the sun, the animals, they are created for their nature. And that nature is, by definition, good. However, when it comes to man is only good when he perfects himself. So man is not good at creation. He has to do something to be good, whereas everything else, their nature automatically is to do good. Just think of it for a minute. Other than man, is there any other creature in the animal kingdom that injures themselves intentionally, smokes, takes drugs, does things like that? Of course not. Do any animals kill for the sake of killing? They kill to survive. Man is the only creature that, because it has an intellect, because it has free will, and as opposed to just instinct, can choose good or bad, and often chooses bad. So his point is that precisely it doesn't say it was good when man is created, because it isn't yet good. It only becomes good or bad, depending on what man does. But man is, like, the creation of man is a test. It's giving man the option to be good or bad. It's not bad inherently. And I thought that was a very good insight. Not really, Jonathan. I don't think so, because fallen man means you're born inherently with this original sin upon you, that you then have to find Jesus and find grace and get rid of it, and then you'll enter heaven. Judaism has never asserted that, but what it does say is that you're born with a dark side, an evil inclination, not original sin. Remember what the verse says after Noah comes after the flood. The imagination of man's heart is evil. Not that man is evil. There is a dark side, and this obviously fits in very well with conservative perspectives on human nature, that there is this dark side, and I dare say that, look at human history, look at the 20th century, as soon as, there's this debate among the Greek philosophers, is man good because he's by nature good, or is man good because of, he's kept good because of the laws? You don't assume that most people will do bad. They don't. Most people don't shoplift or anything like that. But look, for example, at the L.A. riots, things like that. when there's no police, then all of a sudden all sorts of people start stealing because they think it's now okay. Look in countries like Rwanda, Nazi Germany, when there's no longer a law telling you not to kill, plenty of people are involved in killing. So none of us know how we would react. And we can live an entire life as tzaddikim, but it's only because there's a law in place. So it's not saying that Judaism is only saying that there was an evil inclination. And if you look through the Bible, it's a constant stress on being good. The implication is clearly you're not good naturally. You need to work at it. And if being good came naturally, then there'd be no great advantage or no great significance in being good. It's the fact that it doesn't come naturally. It's a lot of hard work. So, and that's Ben Amozig's, what I think is an incredible chidush, that it's not good when man is created, inherently, because man has that choice. It's up to man whether he's good or not. I have not seen that insight in any other commentary, and if you open up a chumash, you'll see. It fits in very well, because God is reflecting on creation as a whole. He specifically does not say it is very good when man is created, even though, as I mentioned, that is the standard explanation of all the commentaries. I haven't checked, by the way. I should check his Peirush on Bereishit. He might say that in the Hebrew. Two more quick points from his Chumash Ein LaMikra. Just quickly, if you look in, when you get a chance, you can look in Leviticus, chapter 10, verse 3. It says, Moses said to Aaron, and then it quotes, Moses tells Aaron what God told him. And Ben Amozig comments there that nowhere in Chumash do we see what Moses reports to Aaron that Moses was told. And that is just another one of his many proofs that what we have here in the Chumash is just a small sample of divine revelation. I mean, you could assert the Torah Shebaal Peh, you could say all these things, but Ben Amozig is showing you from the Chumash itself to see that there is other things that are not included in here. And finally, this is the last thing I'll point out. In his commentary to Leviticus Vayikra, chapter 13, verse 12, and I just mentioned it in case any of you want to check it on your own, the verse is referring to, actually two more things I want to tell you. He quotes Rishonim there, who say that if you find someone killed on the street, don't clean the body as we normally do. You bury him as is. And everyone wants to know, everyone discusses, where the Rishonim, the medieval authorities, get this. It's not mentioned anywhere in the Talmud. This was, unfortunately, a practical case in medieval times when there were many pogroms. He points out that Jerome, translator of the Latin Vulgate, who studied with Jewish teachers and reflects Jewish traditions, in his translation of the biblical verse, he speaks of a person there killed by Beit Din, the court, that there's no washing. Ben Amozig therefore assumes that Jerome is reflecting an ancient Jewish tradition, and this helps us understand where this idea comes from, that someone who's killed, even though Jerome is only speaking to Beit Din, he explains, and this would apply to everyone. And finally, and it's a good thing to end on, in Vayikra, this is the only place you'll find this, chapter 18, verse 25, it's speaking about people who sin in the land of Israel. I'll read you the exact verse. It says, the land, Vatitzma Ha'aretz, the land will be impure. Because it'll be defiled, the land was defiled by the inhabitants of Canaan, who did all sorts of abominable things. That's, so what does that mean, the land was defiled? I think most people, and he quotes here, says that this and actually found in the appendix to the commentary. I'll just summarize. He says if you understand Kabbalah, what he calls truth, Chachmat Emet, you'll know that sin pogain the mitziut kulo. Sin affects the essence of something. And therefore, uvifrat ba'aretz, Johnny Yoshiba, and in particular in the land that we live in. And especially, he says, in the land of Israel, which is the place of the Shechina. So he rejects Shadhal, and he develops the idea, Kabbalistically, that the land itself becomes impure. This is not because, how can a land be impure? We usually think of a person impure, but no. The land itself, in ways that we don't understand it, inherently becomes impure. So this is an example of his Kabbalistic inclination. So with that, and again, I apologize for my voice, although I hope you can hear me. I think you can. We end with Rabbi Eliel ben Amozig. I think for some of you, it was your first exposure to him. I hope that you found it interesting, at least from the questions I received from many of you. I think you did. As I said, he's a figure who's undergoing a great revival in the last 15 or 20 years, not just through Rabbi Zaini's efforts, through many others. Rabbi Bitzal Naor, who's spoken to her in motion, he's written about him, and numerous others. So we will now end. Very good. We will now end with Ben Amozig. And one of you did, I don't know if he's here now with us. One of you emailed me that Shmuley Boteach had a column the day after last week's class talking about, as if he's quoting Ben Amozig. I don't think Shmuley Boteach knows Ben Amozig, but he's talking about how we have to be a light to the nations, we have to bring them Jewish values. He speaks about make Friday night into family night and everything. So the email sent to me was this something very Ben Amozig-esque. So we're going to move on now to another great figure, Rabbi Joseph Messas. Picture of him in his older age. Show you a picture of him in his younger age. We are now moving, it's Larry Coburn, he's right there typing. He's the one who sent it to me. We are moving now from Italy to Morocco. We've spoken in the past about a Sephardic mentality, very different than an Ashkenazic mentality. Following the news from Israel, you've been reading about the controversy about Rabbi Chaim Amsalem. Rabbi Amsalem wants to bring back this Sephardic mentality. And I guess Rav Avadya Yosef tolerated him for pretty long, and that ended today when they asked him to resign his seat. It was one thing when he was arguing to make conversion easier, not so difficult. But when he starts talking about how all these yeshiva guys have to get out of yeshivas and go to work, and that's the Sephardic approach, that became a little too much. We'll get back to him later. But we're moving. You might recall, we did deal with a certain Rabbi Messas. That was Rabbi Shalom Messas, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, the cousin of Rabbi Yosef Messas. And they actually, they recently have put out a stamp. Here is a stamp for, an Israeli stamp for Rabbi Shalom Messas. He had, I think, 4 classes on Rabbi Shalom Messas, on the Pride of Morocco, which you can download from the site. But now we're moving on to Rabbi Yosef Messas. He is really an incredible figure. He is another of those figures who had a certain significance in his lifetime, even more than certain. Among the Sephardim, a good deal of significance. You could see this from the fact that in Israel, I just tried this earlier today on the internet, there are at least 3 streets in Israel named Rehov Yosef Messas. One in Haifa, where he was chief rabbi, one in Ashdod, and one in Kiryat Yam. There might be others as well. And the fact that you get a street named after you shows your significance. But after his death, 1974, he was pretty much forgotten about. Until about 10 years ago, there was a revival of interest in him. And if you plug his name into the internet, you'll get all sorts of sites. I have to say that I knew nothing about him. When I got to Harvard in 1989, I found his books on the bookcase, and I started looking at them and said, this is incredible. I had never even heard of him. To show you how his significance is growing, just last year, 2 years ago, appeared this book, Od Yosef Chai, to play on Od Yosef Chai that appears in the Bible. Jacob says, does my son Joseph still lives? This is a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, an Aruch Chaim, based on his Psakim. And just to let you know what we're going to see a bit, the author, though, marks off those Psakim, those rulings, which he says are not accepted today. So already you see that this is going to be an interesting figure. Some of his rulings... okay, you mean you plug in Joseph Messas, that's interesting. But if you plug in Yosef Messas in the Hebrew, you'll find many others. And I actually have some involvement in making him popular, not just through the Ideals article, but through something else, as we'll see soon, in the halachic literature. Some of his rulings, though, are so far removed from the mainstream of halachic thought that you might be tempted to regard him as outside the realm of orthodoxy. Yet, as I said, he is, in addition to being chief rabbi of Haifa, he was a central figure in the Moroccan Torah world, and a central figure in Sephardic halacha. You know, Ashkenazim have a conception often over what's the Torah world. When, you know, people are attacked from the Lithuanian segment, they always view them as outside the fold. But why people would have this perception, we will see. Now, we see how respected he was by the fact that his responsa are found in the writings of a number of contemporaries. And let me just show you here. I don't know if you can see it. Well, I'll make a copy of it, how he's described. You can't really tell that well. All the titles. Maran Hagon HaMaforsam, Avir HaRoim, Sabbat Mishpatim, Rufkata De'Oraita, Ner Yisrael, Amud HaYemini, Patish HaChazak, Rav Hod Yosef, Sinai V'Oker Harim, HaMaforsam V'Sifra V'Yakarim, Ner HaMarav, Atzor V'Rav, Mishayarei Knesset Agdola, Admar, Kvod Kedushat Shem Tifarto, Reino HaRav Yosef Messas. I mean, it goes on and on. I think what you can say, therefore, is the fact that Yosef Messas could be who he was shows you how diverse Torah true Jewry can be, especially when there is no need to create artificial boundaries between denominations. We have denominations. We've spoken about this many times. We have the Orthodox and the Conservative and the Reform. And therefore, we can't do certain things because people will say, well, we're like the Conservatives. And if the Conservatives did it, then we can't do it. When they came out with their prenuptial type agreements, it took us 40 years to do it. And the same thing with the Bat Mitzvah. If you have a society where you don't have any of these issues, halacha could develop in a much more natural and organic fashion. Just imagine all the times where a posek says, technically this is permissible, but we can't do it because of where it will lead to. Just imagine if you took out all those caveats, because you didn't need to be concerned about those issues, you'd have a very different sort of halacha. Now, if I have to find a parallel, Rabbi Yosef Messas in the Ashkenazic world, it would be Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson. He had, I think, 4 classes out. But unlike Hirschenson, who was always a bit on the outs, yes, he was respected. In fact, I don't have it here. I'm going to bring it in a future class. We found a record of his 70th birthday, how all the great rabbis came together to celebrate it. But he was always regarded as a bit eccentric. His views were never accepted in halacha. Yosef Messas was at the center of the Moroccan rabbinate. But just like Hirschenson, Messas had a vision of Judaism and Jewish law, which I think everyone will find unique. Now, he shows a unique streak in every area he deals with. I don't think there was another North African rabbi who came close to his intellectual versatility. Yet, to apply this versatility, this originality, to matters of halakha required both a clear vision and also an enormous amount of self-confidence. Understand what I mean when you hear some of his ideas. Let us begin with his biography, as we always do. He's born in the city of Meknes. I'll show it to you right now where it is. I don't know how many of you have been to Morocco. I have actually never been to Meknes. If this summer Torah in Motion trip to Europe is successful, maybe we'll go to Meknes and in Morocco in the future. See, it's right below the big cities in Morocco, the Jewish cities. Not Rabat, by the way. Rabat was not a big Jewish city, although it's the capital. Obviously, Casablanca, Fez, Tangier, which is really Spanish, and Marrakesh over here are the real big cities. Safi also is a big city, in Agadir. When I say big, I mean nice population. And Meknes. There's very few Jews today. I don't even know if there's 3,000 Jews. You have Chabad in Casablanca. Although when I was there about 10 years ago for my second time, there still was a kosher restaurant in Marrakesh. There's nothing to see in Casablanca. It's just a city. But Marrakesh and Fez, and they're worth going to. He's born in Meknes. Important. The family, Mestas, is an important family. Great rabbis. He studies in a local yeshiva run by another great rabbi named Berdugo. His father dies when Mesas is 14, so he has to go out and work. Truly, all the Sephardic rabbis worked, with exceptions of those who had full-time rabbinic positions, which was not many, they worked for a living. But obviously, throughout his working, he continues his studies. We have letters he wrote in his teens. And the Hebrew style, the Melitza style, is beautiful. Some of these Sephardim, by their teens, knew Hebrew backwards and forwards. In 1924, when he's 32 years old, he accepts a position. He wanted to be a rabbi, so he accepts a position in Tlemcen, Algeria. So it's on the border of Morocco. See it right here. Oran is the big city, but Tlemcen has a nice Jewish community. You see how close it is to Morocco. It's very much culturally very similar to Morocco. These were both French-controlled, Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. He remains in Tlemcen for 17 years. And while there, we know he had very good relations with not only the French rulers, but also the local Arabs. Yet Tlemcen was not like Meknes. Tlemcen was a very assimilated community. There was a distinction between Tunisia, Morocco, and Algeria. Algeria was regarded by France as really part of France, not really a colony. They thought it was really France, and those of you who know your history will know a terrible civil war was fought, a revolution against France by the locals. And the famous movie and earlier the book, Day of the Jackal, revolves around people who want to take revenge against the French president for letting go of Algeria. But because it was so French, assimilation was also much higher. When I say assimilation, I'm talking about both intermarriage with Jews and French Christians, but also just adopting non-Orthodox lifestyle. I shouldn't use the term Orthodox. There's no conservative there. So there's just Jews, some more observant than others. So Mesas is in this city, Tlemcen. For the first time, he's in a community where most people are not observant. Most people are not Shomer Shabbos. In Meknes, you had some Jews who were not Shomer Shabbos, but most were traditional. And when I say not Shomer Shabbos, very few would have their stores open on Saturday. They might have not been so medoctic in all the little things, but you didn't have that many openly almost secular type Jews, like you had in Tlemcen. Well, we find good treatments of the halakhic issues he discussed in a volume of responses that he published early on in his life. Here's a title page from this first edition there, published in Fez. What year is it published? I forget. I believe it's published in the 40s. I don't want to take the time now to figure out the Tuf Reish. You have Mem Chaf, Tuf Reish Samech. I'd have to figure it out. I don't want to take the time to figure it out. I thought it was sometime in the 30s, maybe or early 40s. You see, if one of you want to take the time while I'm writing here and calculate it, I think something's missing here anyway, because Tuf Reish Samech would be 1900, not 1908. I think what you have to do is you have to take Tuf Reish Sadi Vav Aleph. I think it should be 1936. In any event, just to show you some of the examples of Sephardic religiosity that we don't have in the Ashkenazic world. In volume 1, that's this volume, number 207, he discusses the Hilulot. What are Hilulot? A Hilula is the Yortzeit of a Tzaddik. The Hasidim also do this. They celebrate it. It's not a day of mourning. It's a day of celebration. In fact, the Hasidim have an actual Sudas Mitzvah, a feast, in honor of the dead Tzaddik, because they believe that the soul of the Tzaddik is always rising up. It's happy where it is. And the Sephardim also have great gatherings and rejoicing. The most famous is Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer is very much a Moroccan place. Ceremony is very Moroccan. They dominate it because it's really the Moroccans, or that whole North African culture, that created all these Hilulot. And there's a study by ethnographers, interviewed all these Moroccans who went on Aliyah in the 50s, and they have a list of, I think, like 500 different saints. So basically, every day of the week, you can go to another saint's grave and have a celebration. So the Hilulot is a form of Sephardic religious folklore that was central to the lives of the religious masses. They'd go there, they'd sing, they'd dance, they'd eat candles, they thought that their prayers could be answered. In the past, we've spoken about the fine line between praying to God at a cemetery and praying to the saints. We know that many of these Sephardim would actually pray to the saints. So Rabbi Messas doesn't like this at all. But he describes it. And he writes about how people will violate Shabbos to go to Hilula. From an Ashkenazic perspective, this makes no sense. But they would drive their cars on Shabbos to get to the cemetery to take part in the Hilula. Here is a perfect example of folk religiosity, of a certain spiritual connection, triumphing over Jewish law. You're going to tell these people you can't observe, you can't violate Shabbos? They'll say, I'm not so religious when it comes to Shabbos. But that doesn't mean you're not religious. These are the Sephardim that you see, the guys who have the falafel stands that don't wear yarmulkes, are not Shomer Shabbos, but have pictures of great rabbis on their wall. Only Sephardic great rabbis will kiss their hands and do all sorts of things like this. It's an ethnic, cultural religiosity that we don't have in the Ashkenazic world. He speaks about people who would violate Shabbos in Tlemcen to buy chickens for kaparot. So when I say secular, I don't mean secular in the Ashkenazic sense. I mean people who are attached to certain types of ethnic rituals, but day in and day out are not involved in Judaism. Rosh Hashanah, though, of course, from Kippur, and you need to do kaparos. I saw this firsthand when I worked in Deal at one of the Syrian camps there. People who were hardly what we would call Orthodox, and would violate all sorts of things, and yet other things they were very careful on. Taras HaMishpacha, they would fast on certain fast days, which if you compare, you know, maybe Shabbos or Kashrus, things they would violate to these fast days, it doesn't make any sense at all. And yet they'd be makpid on these little things, and not makpid, not stringent on the big things. there was also real halachic issues in Tlemcen. He was asked, what about the wine touched by the Jews in Tlemcen? If you, next time you go to a simcha, pay attention, the wine will be not be mavushal. It'll be mavushal, it'll be cooked wine. Because we don't use wine touched by non-Jews or even poured, unless it's been pasteurized. However, they didn't have any pasteurization or anything in Morocco and Algeria. This is just regular wine. So then what to do about a Shomer Shabbos? Some early sources, which speak about a non-Shomer Shabbos as being like a non-Jew, they apply this in all categories. Even touching wine. Others disagree, but there are many who say that an Machal Shabbos can't touch the wine either. And Mesos acknowledges that according to strict halacha, this should be the law. If you go to the Carmel Wine Factory in Israel, you'll see they only have Shomer Shabbos involved in the making of the wine. But he says that today, where everyone in our community basically is Machal Shabbos, we have to find a way to be Mohammed Schos. This is going to be an important factor. Trying to find justification for how people live. And this is where his halachic originality really comes to the fore. Let me give you some examples. We can't let people think they've given up the religion. We can't let people think they're sinners. Because if they think they're sinners, we'll throw it all out. They do not think they're sinners. They might violate Shabbos, but they think that that's okay. That the rabbi is more strict, I'm less strict. They don't think these things are obligatory. They think it depends on the individual. And they think that they're pious people. And that's important, because if you let them think that they're sinners, then there's no need for them to have any connection. So you need to be Mohammed Sos, he says, to find justifications. And let me give you some examples of how far this can go. He arrives in the city, like I say, in 1924. And he finds that although they have proper shlita, shochtim, what happens after the shlita? After shlita, the meat goes to the kosher butcher shops. That's the way it has been throughout Jewish history. Every city in Europe and in North Africa would have shochtim. The shochtim had to be pious Jews. They had to have their knives checked by the rabbi. And the rabbi was a mashkiach over the shochet. But what happened after the shochet? Shechted the food. The food then was taken to the butcher who prepared it. There was never a mashkiach on the butcher. What do you need a mashkiach on a butcher for? The butcher's a Shomer Shabbos. He's a firm Jew. I can eat at your house if you're a Shomer Shabbos. You prepare food for me. So why can't I, what do I need a, what do you know, a mashkiach for a butcher? There wasn't such a concept. Everyone was in a community, they were all religious. As long as the meat was shechted properly, then it was given to the butcher who prepared it. You didn't have a situation like you had in Muncie a couple of years ago. It never occurred to anyone that a Jew is going to take is going to try to get non-kosher food. Maybe it's cheaper. And sell it? Unheard of. I mean, in all these towns, you had little inns. Jews would run little bed and breakfast type places. It's more bed and breakfast. Go there and they'd feed you all three meals a day. Anyone ever heard of a mashkiach? Of course not. The from family, you eat there. So what's the problem? The problem is that you come to Tlemcen. All the butchers are Machale Shabbos. They're not observant. So the whole principle that you can rely on a butcher because he's observant, and just like you eat at his house, and you don't need a mashkiach at his house. And I always wonder sometimes if the rabbis of our community, if the rabbi of your community opened up a little restaurant, you need hashgacha? He's the rabbi. I don't know. But today we put hashgacha on everything, although I mentioned this before. I know I mentioned it because someone who's listening to the tapes is the nephew of the person who owned this hotel. I worked at a hotel, Simcha by the Sea. It existed in the 70s and 80s in Staten Island, run by this Musmach of Lakewood. Feinstein family went there. It was a completely black hat, Haredi, Hasidic crowd. Every Shabbos, they had Sheva Brachos there, Ufrufs, or Mitzvahs. There was no Hashkacha on the place. This was a big institution. Hundreds of guests every Shabbos. Hundreds of guests almost every Shabbos they had in the fair. I could fit 400 guests in that place. Never a Mashkiach. Occasionally the Satmar would come, they'd bring their own Mashkiach. But this was a real kosher hotel. Right on the boardwalk. I'm sure some of you remember it if you're from the New York area. And there never was a Hashkacha on it. And everyone knew it was kosher. And there was a place like this in the Catskills, at least until 10 years ago. There was a restaurant, famous restaurant, no Hashkacha. So that was the old way of doing things. But so here, Nesas arrives in the city. And all the kosher butchers are not observant. So how can you leave the meat? There's this notion that you can't leave the meat when no from Jew sees it. How is it? That's why we double wrap. You don't need to double wrap it. It's enough to single wrap it. You have the post can speak about putting a seal on it. All these things when you're on the airplane, look at how they wrap it. Even if you're in New York and you order from the various kosher restaurants, they'll seal it. I don't think that's such a chashash. I don't think you need to worry about the immigrant bicycle person who's going to be on the way to delivering your pizza. He's going to stop off at the trade place and substitute a trade pizza. I mean, what's the benefit there? He has no benefits. But whatever the case is, I know that they seal it so that when it comes to you, it's completely sealed. No one else had access to it. Here you have a perfect example where non-observant Jews are having access to the meat. They have no ne'emanut. They have no trustworthiness. We cannot eat their food. Now, truth is that this is not an absolute principle. If you look, for example, in the Igros Moshe, he was asked by someone, a person of Baal Tshuva, would go home to his parents, and his parents were not observant, but his parents, you know, some parents react differently to this. His parents were supportive of his choice and were prepared to feed him kosher. That is, to have a special pot for him and special food, make everything kosher. So he asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, though, is this permissible? Because really, how could you trust his mother? And maybe his mother is lying to him and saying it's kosher and it's really not. And Rav Moshe holds that you can trust this because you assume the mother is not going to be deceiving the child. That's a special case. How can you make that assumption about someone else? Certainly someone who's making money off it. This psak of Rav Moshe was used, I saw, in the Israeli army by the, I believe it was the chief chaplain who recently retired. His term was up, Ronitsky. You have on army bases often non-religious Jews making the food there. Can you assume that the food is kosher? And he relied on all this. It's more complicated there because the meat coming in is going to be kosher. But he spoke about other cases. Let's say your non-religious friend in the army has food and he tells you it's kosher. He thought in that case you could also believe him based on Rav Moshe. So what did Mesa say? What did he do? Well, at first glance, there appears to be no way to permit a non-observant butcher who's not Shomer Shabbos. How could you do that? That's the whole reason why we have Mashkichim. Why was that the case? Mesas explains that they tried to open a Shomer Shabbos butcher that wouldn't go. There were very few people who were Shomer Shabbos, and the community didn't want to fund it. So they were left with a situation where either you find a heter, a permission, these butchers, or literally, you have to go without meat. Now, that's a hard problem, because how can you tell people to go without meat? Especially these people are not that observant. If you tell them that they can't eat the meat, they're going to eat the meat anyway. And if they eat the meat anyway, then these butchers aren't going to bother with kosher meat at all, because you just said that their meat's not kosher. And if you say their meat's not kosher, they'll just start selling treif meat. So it's important to see if there's a way to to say, to determine that this meat is really kosher. And let's not forget, if you're in a community, a traditional community like Clemson, people start eating non-kosher, that's the first step to them just forgetting about Judaism completely. That's the problem that Rav Yosef Mesas is confronted with. And he also tells us that other people, I'm assuming he's referring to in Morocco, he says they were defaming, they were stating that it is impossible to keep kosher in the city of Tlemcen. Just like we would say if there was a city, let's say, in America somewhere, and we were convinced that the one kosher butcher was not reliable, we would say, you know, you can't keep kosher there. Mesas, therefore, in one of his earliest acts of halachic daring, see a number of examples of halachic daring. Here he's still a young man, but a big Talmud Chacham. And in case when you hear some of these decisions, you start to wonder about him, take a look at him again. You can see clearly he's a Shomer Shabbos. Now, let me show you the other picture again. Get it up from his older age. Well, how do you find permission for a case like this? He begins his argumentation by saying, according to at least one medieval opinion, the butchers have not violated Shabbos according to Torah law. You need to do something involved with the land to that sort to be in front of witness to violate Torah law. I don't want to get into the details, but he argues that whatever these butchers do, even keeping their stores open on Shabbos, they have not openly violated a biblical prohibition in public. And therefore, in a shat hadchak, in an emergency measure, we can eat their meat. And even he can eat their meat. And he knew that he was going out on a limb with this answer. But he thought that under the circumstances, it was the only proper case, the only proper decision, reality he was confronted with. In many places, he explains that these non-religious, like these non-religious butchers, they're not willful sinners. They're not heretics. They're just people who are not observant. So we can't judge them the same way that the Talmud refers to non-observant, as evil sinners. He says that they have been brainwashed by the French schools, the Alliance schools. In earlier times, he said, it might have been proper to be strict with these people, because that would deter them and say, well, we're going to treat you like a non-Jew. Today, he says, it's important to find leniencies. And this is just one example, and we'll see others, where he shows how dynamic halacha could be. It's a conscious search for leniencies to try to make Jewish law work in a society where most people are not observant. And it leads to some surprising conclusions. Now, it was very hard for people outside of his community to understand what was going on there. We have a responsum in an Ashkenazic work by Rabbi Nathan Leider. Tzion Nefesh Chaya, it's called. He was a rabbi in Europe. I think he was later in America. You can find it on HebrewBooks.org, number 29, in which he writes to Mesas. He receives his volume, and he doesn't understand this psak at all. And he says to him, I can only find one justification, and that's what our sages said. Don't judge your fellow until you are in his place, and I don't know the nature of your country. In other words, this psak just appears so outlandish that you're assuming that non-kosher butchers, you can rely on them? In 1940, that's 16 years after coming to Casablanca, coming to Clemson, he had already, as a big refugee, French hum, the official chief rabbi of Morocco, and he turns it down. He also turns down the opportunity to become chief rabbi of Egypt. In 1941, he returns to his birthplace, Meknes, summoned back to be on the Beis Din there, the Beit Din. I assume he was also the unofficial rabbi of a synagogue, is what usually was the case. I know he preached in shuls, but I'm not sure whether he was had one shul that he was an official rav of. But he was a dayan on the Beit Din. We spoke about Meknes when I dealt with Rabbi Shalom Esas. So I'm not going to repeat this. I'll just say that at this time in Morocco, in the smaller towns, people were still observant Shomer Shabbos. In the bigger cities, it has begun the breakdown. You had people who were not Shomer Shabbos, but most were still much more respectful of religion in Algeria. Now, during his time in Meknes, he becomes recognized as one of the great rabbis in the country. His sermons were famous. Many of them have been published. His lectures, his shiurim to the masses on Pirkei Avos and other things were famous. He is regarded as the only Moroccan rabbi able to connect to those people who were really living a modern lifestyle that is not a halachic lifestyle, at least completely. He was probably the only rabbi in his generation who could speak to the intellectuals, the ones who knew philosophy, modern learning. He continues in this path after making Aliyah in 1964, into Haifa. And in 1965, until his death, chief rabbi of Haifa. So we're dealing with an important figure here. He was able to connect to the non-religious. He didn't even like the term secular and religious. He just spoke in terms of those Jews who are more religious and those who are less. This is a very Sephardic perspective. As I mentioned, he is one of the important Sephardic halachic authorities. And unlike Hirschenson, he is mainstream in Morocco, at least. He really believes in a liberal halacha, just like Hirschenson. That is a halacha that responds to circumstances. If people are not observant, you decide halacha differently than you do if you're in Bnei Brak or Vilna. This is the job of the posek. The posek in America, let's say, or in the Ashkenazic world, the posek is only speaking to the Orthodox. So he doesn't need to be concerned that his ruling, how it's going to reflect on the non-Orthodox, because they're not his congregants. So already now you raise the bar. If you're a posek of the Haredim, they don't really care about the modern Orthodox. They're deciding for their group. And sometimes their groups are very extreme. But if you're a posek in Morocco, decide for the entire community, and you are concerned, and just as concerned, with the Jew who comes a few times a year, how your ruling is going to reflect on him, because you are his rabbi, as you are for the one who comes every week. The Orthodox rabbis we have, they're not concerned with the non-observant, because the non-observant are not their congregants. They don't come to them. Very different in Morocco. It's a Klal Yisrael perspective. And let me give you some examples of the rulings of this famous liberal posek. His most well-known ruling, and all you have to do is plug in his name on the internet, this is the one that always comes up, is he rules halacha l'maaseh in two separate places. In one of the places, in great length, that since we are now in an era where most women do not cover their hair, it is no longer an obligation for a married Jewish woman to cover her hair. His own wife did cover her hair. How do I know this? I was in Paris. Oh, it's 15 years ago. And I'm just walking in the Jewish area, and I walk into a shoe store. And I'm talking to the guy in Hebrew. They all speak beautiful Hebrew in Paris. In America, we can't teach Hebrew for some reason. Kids are in day school for 12 years. They come out not speaking Hebrew, and I speak for myself also. We didn't come out speaking any Hebrew, unless you go to Flatbush. And yet you go to these countries like France, and they all speak fluent Hebrew. So I'm talking to this guy, and he tells me his name is Messas. And I say, I'm from the family, and lo and behold, he's a nephew. His name was Gabriel Messas. Probably still there in a shoe store. I have his phone number and address still. He was a nephew of Rav Yosef Messas, and he studied with him in Meknes, and he went down to the basement and pulled out the books. And I spoke to him about Rav Yosef Messas. And he told me that Rav Yosef Messas' wife indeed always covered her hair. But yet, his psak is that this is erva, nakedness, but only in an era when most Jewish women cover their hair. But if they don't, they leave it uncovered, it ceases to be nakedness and it is now permissible. A radical ruling. I think from the traditional rabbinic perspective, at least the radical ruling today, Michael Broyd, in his recent article on the topic, has obviously argued this point, quoting Mesas. This opinion, I'll tell you, was, when I say that I have some involvement in making it popular, is because there's another Moroccan rabbi. His name was Ramosha Malka. He was the chief rabbi of Petach Tikva. He died about 10 years ago. And in his volumes of responsa, there's a number of responsa to me. He was, I'm not going to say a follower, but he was a great admirer and close to Rabbi Yosef Mesas. He comes from Morocco and Malka, and he comes to Petach Tikva and becomes chief rabbi. He's the one that led, if you recall, when the movie theaters were open on Shabbos. He led the strikes, that the protests they would have every Friday night in front of the movie theaters. And then what happened was, after about 4 or 5 months, when he saw it wasn't going to change the mind of this movie theater that was open every Friday night, he gave a ruling that they should stop the protests. There's no purpose anymore in it. It causes more Chil Shabbos because the police have to come. And he published this in Tehumen, which is the Halachic annual. And together they included articles in support of his position, as well as articles against him. And Rebbe Yoshev is against him and writes an article, a letter there to him, published in Tehumen, that they have to keep up the protests. And the Ashkenazic rabbi in Petach Tikva continued the protests. But Rav Malka said, we're not obligated to protest anymore. We protested, not listening. What's the point? We don't got to go out there every Friday night to make fools of ourselves and to stand there, and it's causing more Chil Shabbos. Enough is enough, he said. All we have to do is tell people it's Shabbos, and if they don't want to listen, that's their problem. In his volume of responsa, Beheshiv Moshe, he responds to Melech Shapiro, me, about Rav Yosef Mesas' tshuva, and he has two separate responsa there in which he affirms and defends Rav Yosef Mesas' ruling that this is absolutely correct. I think this is interesting because here you have a chief rabbi of an Israeli city in the 1990s still able to say that this is permissible, that you don't need to go. It's a pious practice, but it's not an obligatory practice. And young brides getting married in Petach Tikva who go ask Rabbi Malka, do I need to cover their hair? He was saying to them, you don't need to. Today's day and age, you don't need to. If you want to, you'll be pious. So that's why Rav Yosef Mesas is known by so many people. In fact, that's the only reason he's known by lots of people. And that ruling is quoted over and over again. Of course, they never take any of his chumras, any of his stringencies, and he has stringencies. But that leniency, everyone knows. And this is also based on Limud Zchus. He said, the question is phrased in the responsa, today we have many wives of rabbis and shochtim who don't cover their hair. Is this permissible? And it's obvious he's not coming into society where, you know, like a B'nai Brak type society where all the women are covering their hair and telling them to now uncover your hair. He's talking about society where already they aren't covering their hair, and he's being Mohammed Zchus. He's finding a justification to permit it. This theory of his that we need to be Mohammed Zchus, we need to find permissibility, he finds this all throughout his writings, including in an approbation. He has a Melitza, a very flowery introduction to his cousin, Rav Shalom Mesas's book on Kashrus, Yoradeya, called Mizrach Shemesh, and in there he writes about how certain people, certain rabbis, although they're very learned, they want to constantly increase Chumrot Kasot, constantly make more stringencies, especially in food matters, always making it more difficult. And he says that that's not the proper approach. And our job is actually to affirm the way people are right now, of course, if you can affirm it. But that means no chumras, and even more so, trying to find leniencies if people are doing it. Now, it's already 10 o'clock and I can barely stand anymore with my voice. It's a combination of being sick and screaming in the two games I coached yesterday in soccer. But hopefully by next week, my voice will be back. And we'll look at some other aspects of his halachic vision, some unusual tshuvot, and his involvement in certain controversies. He got very involved in the controversy over Rav Kook's writings and other aspects of his non-halachic approaches. So I will wait on a few more minutes if anyone has any questions. For those who are interested, we will probably spend probably just two, maybe not, three classes on Rav Yosef Mesas, and then we're going to move into the Sipur. Then we move right back into the heart of Haredi society, a society which I believe we are seeing the beginnings of the end, beginnings of the crumblings of Haredi society as we have known it. And I'll explain why, you know, when we get to it. There are already about four or five schools that have opened up for Ashkenazi Haredi men to teach them professions. Poverty is grinding. See, this Rabbi Amsalem is not going to be silenced. He's going to open his own, probably by his own party. I just think that there's many signs that it's not going to come to fruition in the current Gedolim. You're going to need a new rabbinic class that's going to come on the scene with a different vision. But it just seems to me the demographics, people have had enough already that we are going to start seeing real changes. And that is significant because the Sipur is really the beginning of this. Him and Rav Shach are the prime molders of this new Haredi model of living. This innovation of where everyone is supported. They study all day, and labor is not valued, even though the Gemara says that the Sipur deals with it. The Gemara says explicitly, if you don't study, if you don't work, as if all you do is study, it'll lead to thievery. And there's all sorts of passages like that. So we'll see what they say. You know, they know these sources. But the society of learners, the Chevrat HaLamdim, which now is some 60,000 strong, really takes off during the Sipur's reign. Chazon Ish gave the philosophical justification type of life. But during his lifetime, you never had this. It really only begins in the 1970s, and the Sipur is able to correct it. And the Sipur comes from a very extreme segment of Haredi society. Had Haredi society in Israel developed along the Jerusalem model, the Yeshivas Kol Torah, the Hebron model, it would have been very different. But we'll see where the extremism comes from. Just like had American Haredi society developed along the Torah Vadas, or the Mir model, or the Chaim Berlin model. These guys all went to college at night. They all had professions. It would have been a very different Haredi America, but yet it became because Rav Aaron Cutler triumphed. So we will talk a lot about that. Before we get to that, we still need to look at Rav Yosef Mesas. I just want to let you know what we will be doing. Why didn't it? Let's wait till we get to the Sipur. It's a very good question. I think the reason in Israel is government subsidies. The whole Israeli Haredi society is a fiction. It's based on charity, handouts. It's the biggest welfare state imaginable. Where else do you have a whole society where people are taught to depend on the dole? And it's not the Haredim's fault, it's the government's fault. So you have a welfare state, basically, that supports able-bodied people. So it's an artificial welfare society. And that's why it emerged victorious. Without that, it never could have happened. But we'll get to that. In America, it's different. In America, it triumphed for ideological reasons, but it's funny because in America, you have people who work, and yet they still adopt the Rav Aaron Cutler model. We'll talk about that. No, Ben Amozik isn't a 20th century figure. He dies in 1900. Why they call it on top of your screen of the 20th century, my title is simply Rabbinic Figures in Modern Times. Yeah, I mean, the Kolelniks owe the Rosh Yeshiva and the politicians owe the Haredi leaders. You're asking my opinion. All they have to do is have a unity government, get them all together, in one fell swoop, abolish all these subsidies, and then everyone takes responsibility. You get Kadima in, you get Labor, you get Likud. Let them together as a unity government deal with this, and then they can break away and argue on all these matters. It's never going to be solved unless the issue is forced. And the time is now right, because you have Haredi leaders who are beginning to say, we got to do something about this. But, you know, the Haredi world has always not changed until it's too late. They'll probably wait until it's too late. Now they can have a deal where the best and the brightest will still get government support. Instead, they're going to wait until it's too late. They've already waited until it's too late. Do you know how many lives have been destroyed by this Haredi model? Have been condemned to poverty. It's a form of child abuse. These children grow up. There's no other country in the world, a Western type of country, in which children are permitted to grow up without any education, not even basic math or skills. Parents do not have the right to destroy their children. And the Satmar in America seem to get basic secular education, and they don't become assimilated. They don't regard it as shmad. So, and not only that, the government funds this. It's one thing if you have Satmar in Israel, where they do what they want, but the government funds school systems which teach values in opposition to the state. Yaakov Katz, in his autobiography, said it's the only country in the world where a country funds school systems that not only do not follow basic guidelines of what to teach students, but teach values in opposition to the state. If they want to do that, fine, but don't fund it. So this is all going to have to end soon, because right now, 25% of first graders are Haredi. That means in another 13, 14 years, they go to the army. Can you have a situation where one quarter of the population doesn't go to the army? Why should any mother send their son to the army? I wouldn't send my kid to the army if 25% of the country's not going to the army. I mean, you can't have a society like that. And you're supposed to support everyone on welfare? So, and if you heard what happened yesterday with the Kollels there, so something's going to change, and it's going to change in the next 5 years. I'm certain of that. But this society of learners, we will discuss how it developed. The subsidies are everything. The subsidies are everything. Haredi society would collapse tomorrow without the subsidies. And I got news for you. I think a good portion of it would collapse tomorrow if the government said you can get a job without going to the army. Problem is, these people won't go to the army. And you can't get a job, really, unless you go to the army, unless you work under the table. But how was that fair? That they don't go to the army? But if the subsidies collapsed, if the subsidies ended, the whole society would collapse, and they'd go into the Nachal Haredi, or whatever they'd call it. So subsidies are everything. They're echoed Ben Amozi quotes Kabbalist, he says it's in Kabbalah. You find it in Kabbalistic writing. I don't see the comment screen now. If tech support can get the comment screen back. You find Rav Kook, for example. Tech support, can we get the comment screen back? Okay, hold on. Yes, you do find it in Kabbalistic writers. You find even the Zohar speaks about certain positive things in Christianity. He's referring to Edom and Esav, so that's Christianity. Rav Kook speaks about the positive aspects of idolatry. Kabbalists, the Kubalim, speak about how everything, even the most evil, even the lowest level of Tuma, have sparks of holiness. We just have to know how to bring them out. And that's why the Hasidic Rebbe's will descend, try to bring us up. Shabtai Tzvi, his conversion was interpreted along those lines of descending into the Tuma. So therefore, you could say that for Ben Amozi to speak about sparks of holiness, even in paganism, that is mainstream Kabbalistic thought. That they have sparks. So what are the sparks? That's the question. So Rav Kook spoke about this connection to spirituality, this holy religiosity, unfortunately, pushed in the wrong direction. He spoke about how Jesus even had a holy religiosity, which is perverted. And other Mekubalim think the same thing, that that's why Avodah Zarah is so dangerous. because there's a primal sense of religiosity, a connection to paganism, which is such a Yetzer Hara. But we just have to move that into a better direction. I think it's a lot of things. First of all, it's the fact that there wasn't reform. There wasn't irreligious movements. When you have an irreligious movement, a movement intent on destroying traditional Judaism, you are going to respond harsher. You were also in societies that didn't have secularism to a large extent, didn't have anti-religious movements. If you look in Europe, people were influenced by ideologies like socialism, communism, secularism, secular Zionism. All these movements turned people not just irreligious, but often anti-religious. So therefore, that's going to create a reaction, first of all. And also, your community is going to be only the pious, only the Shomer Shabbos. Like many of our communities are now only Shomer Shabbos. When you have a situation like that, you're not going to find this moderation. Also, secular studies. Italy, for example, they all were secularly educated. They all had an appreciation for secular learning. That's going to almost always tend to moderation. True, in places like Morocco, you didn't have secular learning, but what you had is one community. When the rabbi is responsible for everyone, he relates differently. He has to deal with all sorts of people. So you never had this sort of extremism. And you never had much of it in the Ashkenazic world. You had it in Hungary. You had it in Germany. You didn't have it in Lithuania. When we get to the Stipur, we'll see that the extremism, which we'll see in the Stipur and Rav Shach, is not mainstream Lithuanian society. We spoke about this already. Mainstream Lithuanian society was not an extreme society at all. There were Torim Derech Eretz schools throughout Lithuania. Chavno Rav was the spiritual guide for them. And also, Neister Goyim is important. When you're in a society, like in Germany, before things got bad, and Italy, where the non-Jews, or Spain in the Golden Age, when the non-Jews welcome you, and they value you, then you in turn value the non-Jews. And when you value non-Jews, you value non-Jewish culture. And if you value non-Jewish culture, that basically is going to lead to more moderation and more open-mindedness. So they all combine. But even in the United States, I mean, there is a welfare state, but it's a different type of welfare state. People get help. But the idea, you cannot just sit and do nothing in America and expect to be supported. You can get food stamps and things like that, but you're not going to get a check in the mail. In Israel, you get checks in the mail. First of all, you get checks for children, and you also get checks, not large checks, but if the wife works, and you do a little illegal work under the table, and there's a little cheating, and you get money from the government, you get money from the kids, you can survive. Can Israel survive with the lost productivity? There was an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple days ago about this. It can't go on. We'll talk about it. You can get Section 8. And you can get Medicaid, but you can't get actually welfare checks. You can survive, you're right. You can, some people can survive, but they've cut down a lot of it, on this a lot. And welfare from mommy or daddy doesn't exist that much anymore. First of all, many people, if you have lots of kids, you can't support them all. In America, it's changed a lot. You don't have this in America so much. Most of these people eventually have to go to work. Very few people can stay in kol their life. In Israel, you have it. So that's the situation in Israel. My voice is dying here, so I'm going to have to stop. These are all very good issues, very good questions. We will pick up with them when we get to the future. I'm going to deal lots more coming on all these matters. Thank you. Bye-bye.